Hello and Merry Christmas, everybody, and welcome to our less than festive film choice for this year of War Games.
It's not even arguably a Christmas film.
It's not even arguably a Christmas. It's not like Die Hard. So Michael and I are going to talk about War Games. Before that, I will just say, as it's Christmas Day, this is also the day that Tmudwup returns. So later, well, if you're listening to this on Christmas morning, which of course you will be, there's new Tmudwup this afternoon. If you're listening to this after that, then you'll have both this and that to choose from.
And if you're listening to this on the Tin Dog podcast feed, go over and listen to the Tmudwup. There you go.
Of course, yes, because this will be coming out on the Tin Dog podcast feed sometime after Christmas Day.
Yes.
In which case, Happy New Year. So this was originally on my list, my long list of things was originally
and
on my
mine.
List. And yours. And then we did The Breakfast Club about a year ago at the behest of your wife. And you were saying that you didn't know Ali, you only knew Ali Sheedy from something else. And I was like, well, you do know us from something else, surely. And you were like, oh yeah, War Games. And I was like, ah, okay, we've both got this on our list. So we sort of banked it to do it as our Christmas episode. So, Michael, this came out in 1983. Did you see it at the time? What's your history with the film?
I was 11, didn't see it at the time at all. Think I saw it on VHS. Borrowed it from the VHS. So we're looking at... What year did you say, 83?
83, yeah.
Right, okay. So 84, I'm 12. That's about the time when it was sort of... Well, Nobles was our corner shop, and they bought the... Well, it used to be a VG, and then it turned into a handyman shop, and they turned that into a VHS rental shop. And that's where that was like the one in our local area. So that's where I would have got War Games from, and we would have watched it then. I'm pretty sure I watched it with my dad, because even to this day, he still quotes it.
Right.
Right. He can be in the middle of something and then all of a sudden announce confidence is high. And it's not Doctor Strangelove or any of those others. It's definitely
it's
this
definitely
film.
It's definitely War Games. Yeah.
Yeah.
Confidence
and also
is high,
when he wants to play a game of chess with Verity, he does actually an impression. So yeah. So I definitely watched this on VHS from the local shop with my dad, and it was one of those ones. So this was the closest I got to a Brad Pack film in the 80s, because I didn't do the others at all.
Yeah.
I did this. I did a lot, you know, Aliens and all of that end of things. And I did a lot of 1950s sci-fi. So that's where my, you know, formative years were. So this was the closest I got to it. And I didn't even see Ferris Bueller's Day Off till much later.
Do you like Ferris Bueller's Day Off?
No, I do not. And I like Matthew Broderick in this film, and I like him in The Producers. They're my two go-to performances for Broderick. I do not like Ferris Bueller in the way that I don't like Tom Good in The Good Life. He's the main character, he's the driving force for it, but he's a monster.
Yes.
And they should have made Ferris Bueller's life, like where he had to grow up, and then he had to try and not grow up in a corporate environment or whatever he was going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which you know what? You could still get Broderick, because he's a great actor, to do that. We'll make it now. Ferris Bueller's retirement.
Yeah.
Right. But so anyway, I don't know. How do you feel about that? Or have I just muddied
the
waters?
No, so I saw Ferris Bueller during my Love Film days, I think, when I was watching lots of films when, you know, that was a thing. And I hated it, absolutely hated it, for precisely
Why?
The same reason.
Oh, yeah, because he's...
Because he's horrible. He's not a nice person.
Well, we're supposed to love him. We're supposed to think he's incredible and marvellous and... Yeah.
And I think also, because, like, this is my other touchstone for Matthew Broderick, you know, I mean, obviously he's Simba in The Lion King, but I kind of tend to forget that he's Simba in The Lion King.
Can I be honest with you? Even although I've got a massive animation background, I didn't know that.
Yes,
I'd never put two and two together.
He's the grown-up Simba. So this was my touch point. This has always been my touch point for Matthew Broderick, because this was the only other place I'd really come across him, because I didn't see Godzilla.
Oh, of course, yeah, Godzilla, the 90s version with the very small Godzilla.
Yes, so there's an interesting connection between Godzilla and my history with this film. But anyway, we'll get back to that. So because he's so likable in War Games, and then you watch Ferris Bueller, and he's just awful.
I want to know your Godzilla connection there.
Well, so my history with this film is it's one of the few things outside of Doctor Who that I have owned on three formats.
Okay.
Actually, to be fair, I don't own a lot of Doctor Who on Blu-ray, do I? So it's one of the few things that I've owned on three formats, VHS, DVD, and Blu-ray. But I did first watch it on DVD, and then I bought it on VHS, because the gap between me watching it on DVD and owning a DVD player was several years. Because I first saw this on a summer camp in, I think it would have been 1998, so very early DVD days. And I went on this camp that I will affectionately call Geek Camp. It was called Transformers, and it was basically for 14 to 17-year-olds, and I went on it every year that I could, so 4 years. And it was the one place that I went every year where I was cool. Because this camp was for people who did programming and sort of graphic editing and video. And the people that went on the camp and did video, i.e. me, we were the cool ones, right? Because we weren't the people that turned up with our PC and made a LAN for the week. And all the leaders.
Oh, those days are long gone. Houses.
Yeah, exactly. All the leaders on the camp kind of had jobs in like software development and things like that.
Yeah.
So it was slightly longer than a week. It was basically a place every year that I could go and be myself, you know. And there was always a film night at some point on the camp, and this was the film, and I'd never heard of it before. We watched it with subtitles. I distinctly remember when the subtitle for horn honks, when the ship is going through the water and it says horn honks, and we all laughed because we'd never watched a film with subtitles before. But because DVDs were this newfangled thing that could do subtitles, we watched it with subtitles. In hindsight, the vast majority of people on that camp were neurodivergent, and as we know, watching things with subtitles is, you know, something that lots of neurodivergent people do.
I couldn't possibly comment. I didn't realise the subtitles had an off switch.
Yes, the signs were there. The link to Godzilla though is that the first year that I was there, there were these guys who were doing video who were actually even cooler than me, who basically did a series of film parodies. And Godzilla had just come out that year, and so one of their film parodies was this guy was called Zico. And they made this little film called Zicozilla. And they literally did the thing of he was standing close to the camera making kind of big clumpy movements, and the rest of the guys were standing 100 metres further away. And they were kind of trying to line up the shots so that, you know, he looked like he was massive and they were kind of tiny. So I have a great fondness for at least the music from that version of Godzilla, even though I've never actually seen the film. But yeah, so I watched it on DVD on the camp, but then I came home, loved it so much, bought it on VHS because, you know, I think it would be about four or five years till I owned a DVD player myself. I bought the Five Doctors on DVD before I had a DVD player to play it on, you know. It was the kind of thing.
First things I think I bought and then, box set-wise was the X-Files, so that kind of dates that one. Because then I went back, because I was buying series 1, 2 and 3... on VHS.
Right.
Similar with Buffy, and then I sold the VHS Buffies and went back and got the DVDs for those. So yeah, that would be around that time.
Yes. And I came to Red Dwarf late enough that I was acquiring it for the first time on DVD. I never had Red Dwarf on VHS. Anyway, and then the last time I watched it, I then was like, right, it's time to buy the Blu-ray. So I bought the Blu-ray, and this was the first time I watched the Blu-ray. So this would be the first time watching the film at the correct speed for all the nerdy people out there. And also, the first time watching it since it's been re-rated a 12.
And what's the thinking behind it being re-rated at 12 then? And what was it?
It was a PG. So it was rated a PG originally in 1986 when it came out on VHS. It was rated PG in the cinema in 1983. It was rated
PG 12 didn't exist until Batman.
No, that's true. Yeah. So it was rated again. It was re-rated PG in 2000 when it was, I guess, released on re-released on DVD or whatever. And it's only been reclassified as a 12 in 2013. And it just says contains moderate language and soft drug references, which is.
But there's at least two of them, and it's weird, right? If we actually want to start talking about the movie, drug references. There's two of them that I'm aware of that jumped out at me, and they're both related to the military. Because there's one at the beginning where the guy who would clearly be in charge of launching weapons is talking about his girlfriend growing marijuana. And I'm thinking, don't you have drug tests? Right? So there's that. And then there's the recording that that Broderick's character plays.
The
dictaphone recording. Yeah. And it says, might be using PCP or meth. And you're like, well, sorry, that's inside a military base. And there's a recording of someone who might be on. And you're, sorry? So the two military characters are on.
It's totally random, that aspect of the film. And I think it's one of those things where I'm just like, well, that probably went largely over my head when I first.
Well, there's another thing that definitely went over my head and it was pointed out to me by my first girlfriend when we watched the film. Right?
Now, right.
Okay, so there's a line in Blues Brothers where they're going through the. Bear with. Where they're going through the context. Contents of his pockets from when he went into jail, and they're handing everything back, and one of them says a propylaptic, and he picks it up, and it's Frank Oz, and he goes used, and then it's like with a pen, and he drops it down. So
right,
okay, and I'm like, okay, condom, propylaptic, done, okay, logged, that's logged. And then I believe my first girlfriend said, but what about War Games? And I went, what? So there's the news gone, and there's an article on the news being played, and then it ends one news article and goes into, last night we almost ended the world.
Yeah.
Which, how it's on the news is beyond me, but it needs to be for narrative purposes.
Yes, it does.
The news article before that, there was a fire at a propylaptic recycling plant.
Yes.
If you listen really carefully, that's the news article that's playing. And I was like, you're sorry, what? Was no one meant to hear that? Because it's very audible. It's there. So I don't know if that was a joke put in for someone, or if it was like meant to be just pointless news. And that was kind of mumbled, and then it was going to come on. Because no one would know. Did anyone notice? I don't know.
When you were starting to say that, I was like, is it? And then when you said what it was, I was like, yeah, no, I did notice that when I was watching it last night.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a throwaway.
It's just a little throwaway line in the background, and you go, no, let me just rewind that. Yes, that's exactly what he said.
Because it's a bit like the scene in Back to the Future where the news is on, and there's the advert for the car that Marty wants, and then there's the news that the plutonium has been stolen, right? And those are both, you know, significant to the plot.
Yeah.
But with this, it's just like, that has absolutely no relevance at all. It's just a joke. It's just a comedy piece of dialogue. But then you've got the whole, you know, the bit in the school where the biology teacher's kind of going through the results and he's like, who first proposed the idea of reproduction without sex? His wife, you know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that kind of humour in the sort of first half of the film where it's, you know, teenage life. In the 80s.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the bit that feels more like your Breakfast Club, your 16 Candles-y type world. And that's it. I did watch some of the making of, which I found on YouTube.
Oh, okay.
And there was some stuff that I'd not considered. And there was something I found out today, which I went, no, that's not right. And also, considering when it was made,
right.
Physically impossible to have happened.
Right, okay.
Okay, but in one of the drafts, you know the whole thing that they started off writing a completely different film?
I had a vague idea that, okay. this went through several iterations before it became.
Guy sits
this.
Down and he watches a documentary about Stephen Hawking, right?
Right. Okay.
And on all the documentaries, they're saying he had ALS, which is what the Americans call motor neuron disease.
Yes.
So, and at this point, Hawkins is in a wheelchair, but he's not as bad as he gets. Obviously, he's dead now, but right. It is a progressive thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were saying, they were worried that the theme of this documentary, this is in 1980.
Right.
The theme of the documentary was, this guy might figure out a unified field theory and not be able to tell anyone.
Right.
Because he'll have like locked in, you know, be locked in by that point.
Yeah,
and obviously
exactly.
Time passed in a different way and, you know, he had the speech synthesizer and all that business. And we can discuss the speech synthesizer and sounding like Stephen Hawking at a completely different time. Because I've got an issue with the speech synthesizer in the film as well, right? Which we'll come back to because it's in my notes. But so the story was going to be that this guy is a genius and he's fading physically and he needs a son character who can relate to his science abilities at the same time and is reaching out to him. And there's a scene where the son character, you know, would be Matthew Broderick's character, arrives at the person who's Falcon, Hawkins, you know what I mean, science. He's and is an electric wheelchair he's fishing on the edge of a pier and he walks up to him and then he turns around and it's John Lennon. And you're like, you what? Why would it be John Lennon? And also, you can't hire him, he's dead. Like, and I know it's the equivalent of getting David Bowie to play a Tesla,
I mean, they've just had the anniversary, hasn't he? So John Lennon was shot at the end of 1980. So if they were making plans in the beginning of 1980,
and
conceivably that was a possibility.
Yeah, well, John Lennon was shot. Was it a fan of Jodie Foster? It doesn't matter. Let's not go down that road now. Because, no, that's mentioned in this. It was like the early 80s was a weird time. Fans were turning poisonous and actors were in the White House. It's like it was just a weird time.
Yes. I mean, it's that thing of like they reference the president multiple times.
Yeah.
And it's one of those films where you're like, well, it could be a fictional president up until that moment where you see a picture of Reagan on the wall next to the DEFCON sign. And you're like, oh, OK, no, we're setting it in the real world, I suppose.
And also apparently they had trouble. So they'd gone down that road writing that script.
Right.
And then the guy who had like hired them to do it went, you don't have to like write it in stone. You can't just write the script and just pass it over to me. You've had a year.
Right.
And then the secretary says, they've brought a script. It's not what you asked for, but you might want to read it anyway. Because they couldn't write that story. They'd written this instead because they'd gone away and done shed loads of research and learnt about, you know, gifted children and it had all turned into computers and what had happened. And they wanted to set it all in literally the real world.
Right. Yeah.
So then it became what we now know as a techno thriller. But now I can't place. Was there ones before this?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, it's one of those films where.
Was that Day of the Falcon? He's just like a sci-fi reader, though, isn't he?
It's really weird, actually, because I was thinking about time in relation to this film because it came out the year before I was born. Right, and I feel this way about Star Wars as well. Star Wars Jedi came out the year before I was born. And stuff that came out just before I arrived in the world feels like there's a wall there and that everything before feels like a long way off, right? Because it was already in existence when I came into the world. And then obviously there's other stuff that, you know, happened in the early years of my life. I think the 80s as a whole, I kind of feel, is sort of distant. And then the 90s is where I kind of start to remember things. But when I think about time, this film was only 15 years old when I watched it.
Yeah.
And it's now over 40 years old, right? But it feels to me like there should be more distance between when it came out and when I first saw it, as it were. And I suppose part of that's just because the world that it portrays, you know, feels quite alien now. I mean, Hannah and I were talking about this. You know, there's like the level of competence that he has.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of his ability, he there's a whole montage where he does research.
No, to the library.
Yes. You know, microfiche, all that kind of stuff.
So, oh God, I love a microfiche machine.
And that whole thing of like he's bright, but he doesn't apply it himself at school because clearly the subjects at school bore him. But then you find the thing that he really likes, which is his computers, and he's prepared.
He doesn't realise he's not been in school. He doesn't.
Yeah, because like, where have you been? And he's just
good Lord, has he hyperfixated on something?
Yeah.
That's the whole thing. That's now how we see it. But there's a lot of characters who are portrayed as a certain thing.
Yes.
Which we can discuss again in a minute. But all we're doing is we're seeing the behaviours. It's like that internet meme. It was like years ago there wasn't anybody who was autistic.
Yeah.
Like, years ago there wasn't. Nobody discovered the planet Pluto until 1927.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yes. I'm pretty sure it was there all along.
Yes.
And it's that kind of thing. There's characters who are perfectly good at their jobs.
Yes.
But are quite sociable. And there's one character who is absolutely the guy who's the assistant in the computer lab.
Yes.
Who's
Malvin.
Who's more,
yeah.
Malvin. Now, I know he's doing like a Jerry Lewis voice, kind of.
Yes.
But he's the sort of person years ago that you would have gone, yeah, he's autistic.
Yes.
Yeah, like you wouldn't have had much of an argument
on
that one.
Yes.
People would have just gone, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then that is that, but he's the character. And also he's actually asked in a quieter moment, when I'm speaking out of character or when I'm being overbearing or something, can you tell me?
Yes.
And that is such classic behaviour.
Yes.
That you're like, yeah, mate, it's fine. Yeah.
There's just, I suppose there's so much in this film that is relatable.
Yeah, that's
even though the situation itself is completely ridiculous, right? And I suppose what works about the film is that they play it straight.
Yeah.
Right. Nobody's taking the piss out of this, right?
Nope.
This is played perfectly straight. Now, can I ask you what your experience of the Cold War was? Because I don't know what it was like to live with the threat of nuclear war. Right. I know what it was like. I know what it was like to hear about it just after the fact, you know, because my first real memory of world events is the Berlin Wall coming down. Right. So to me, it was over by the time I knew what was going on. But this film is obviously a very, very specific time and place. The threat of nuclear war was, as far as I can tell, very real. How much did that factor into your life, you know, when this film was being made and came out?
I thought, okay, you've got... And you're from Sheffield, so you've got Threads.
I didn't see Threads until I was in my
20s. Right,
it would have traumatised me, I think, if I'd seen it
We were shown it while we were at school. Yay.
Yeah.
Right. Hey, kids, let's all watch this.
I was in the womb.
Yeah.
While they were making my dad remembers seeing them.
You were possibly in it because you're from Sheffield, so you go.
Well, my dad remembers walking past bits of it being filmed on his way to work, you know, while my mum was pregnant with me. So, you know, and it came out, you know, I think it came out, I forget when it came out in 84.
Yeah, yeah.
I was born in April, so at some point
there's two stories that happen after this movie comes out, okay?
Right.
Now, so Ronald Reagan, obviously movie actor, gets to see this film at release, watching it in the White House because he got their own cinema.
Right.
Because he likes seeing all the new films. Watches this, goes into a meeting on Monday and says, right, I've just seen a film, explains the entire plot to all of the chiefs of staff. And they're sat there going, we really had a meeting today planned properly? And he's going, no, I've got to tell you this. And he said, my question is, could this happen? Right.
And
so they then go away for 1 month, and the answer is yes. And because of that, they set up a whole internal bit of the FBI. Because in this, he's threatened with espionage.
Yes.
Not with like data fraud or computer hacking or anything like that. Because hacking wasn't really a thing. There was phone freaks and stuff like that. But because of this film, the president then went away and went, right, we now need to look into this. And then all of the incredible high-up people came back and went, actually, it is possible that something else could happen. Now, you know the story of the Russian guy who saved the world by going, eh, forget it.
Yeah, I do.
Now, let's just wait. And that happens 6 months after this movie comes out.
Yes.
So that places it. But there was also something that happened a few years earlier that was similar, where the computers went haywire and said that there was a launch.
Right.
Which happened in the sort of late 70s. So I think the Russian one was meant to be a light bouncing off clouds or something that affected the rate. Anyway, so those things, we were living on kind of a knife edge. And when we, years later, when you found out how close to the knife edge we were living, it just made you go, yeah, we were right to be terrified.
Yes.
See, but my parents' generation had to sit through the height of the Cold War, which is the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd not done that. So my dad had a very nihilistic point of view. It was like, well, if it does happen, there's nought you can do about it, so don't worry about it. That was his approach. It was like, you have zero control over anything. We're in Newcastle. We are a target because the Russians don't know that we don't have a shipbuilding industry anymore. They think we have got a shipbuilding industry, so we are a target. And we've got an airport. We'll be taken out.
Yeah.
So you'll know about it for about, my dad said about 3 minutes. And he was right, because the 4-minute warning was actually for us to alert America that there was something coming. We would already have been taken out, as we discovered later. So although we were supposed to have 4 minutes, no, we wouldn't. We discovered that. That was lovely. And I did get a bit fixated on atomic weaponry at one point, and I did have the blueprints, which were in an album sleeve or something. I knew shed loads about Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the way that there was going to be another place with a bomb dropped on it, but one of the Americans had gone, hey, I had my honeymoon there. Let's not bomb that. Let's bomb somewhere else. It's the whim of people that really scares you. So, yeah, and you were always kind of a bit on edge, and it was in the back of your head, but we never did anything like America with, like, duck and cover. It was just like this background shadow that you tried not to think about. It wasn't even an elephant in the room. It was like a picture of an elephant that you just kind of were aware of, but you were like, yeah, that's the elephant. It's shit. There's nothing we can really do about it. And if you did think about it, you got, you know, it just, your brain ran away with it, and you were like, right, we could all horribly die. But, you know, the number of weapons, it's like when people go, we've got enough weapons to destroy the world 1,000 times, and you're like, yeah, it takes once, not 1,000. What you've got there is overkill.
Yes.
So I did get a bit screechy about that.
Because obviously the following year, Doctor Who does its... I hate to bring up Warriors of the Deep, but Doctor Who
I
does
like
its...
Warriors of the Deep. Well, and I will nail my flag to that.
I like the story.
Whatever the phrase actually is, yeah.
I like the story, and I like many Doctor Who. I read the book first, and then when I eventually saw it, I was like, oh, I can see
it's a good book.
It's a good book. It just needed better lighting and a better monster.
Well, that's what's coming in the next book, sir.
Well, apparently so.
They've digitized the Murker, which sounds like a euphemism for something.
But, you know, like, it feels like it was in the air.
Yeah.
You know, with the stuff like that. And, you know, Superman 4, you know...
Oh, yeah, the quest for peace.
Going to get rid of all the nuclear weapons and throw them into the sun, you know.
Hmm.
But, yeah, I didn't live through it. But, you know, I was introduced to this. Looking back, I'm like, oh, yeah, no. Like, me watching it for the first time is much closer to its original release than me watching it now. Which is kind of, that's just one of those marking the passage of time things. That this film has been with me for a lot longer than I kind of, when I think about it, I'm like, oh yeah, actually this film has been with me for most of my life. But in some ways it feels like I came to it quite late. But that's just a quirk of how one perceives time. You said you had some things to talk about that we were going to come back to. What's
one
in your
of them
notes?
Okay, voice synthesizer. Okay.
Yes.
So she, we can discuss the Ali Sheedy being the narrative heart of the piece in a minute.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Because I'll forget that, because I will. But the voice synthesizer, okay. He flicks a switch, comes out this voice speech synthesizer. That's fine. Okay.
Yes.
You get Joshua's voice. Joshua uses that voice for the entire film. The speech synthesizer's in his room. It's only the actual speaker's only in his room.
Yes.
And then whenever Joshua's like on the big screen or anything like that, we've got the same voice.
Right, yes.
And I've got no problem with that as a narrative tool.
Right.
But you just sat there going, did he like the voice? Was there already a speech synthesizer? Stop thinking about it. Stop thinking about it. That's where I'll go.
So my thought, and I only really thought about it watching it this time, the speech, the synthesized voice sounds like John Wood.
Right. I didn't know who it was.
Who plays Vulcan. And I'm like, is it him doing the voice and they're then kind of treating it electronically? So they're basically giving the computer his voice. Yeah.
What he did, I don't know. He made him read the sentences backwards. So, he didn't read the words backwards. It wasn't like years left and years left. Don't play that backwards because that meant nothing. That was just me making a noise. Sometimes my arms bend backwards. Anyway, I really must get around to a Twin Peaks rewatch. So what he did was they wrote the sentence out, but he made the words come out so that it sounded like when his speech was being synthesized by a machine, it was choosing individual words from its lexicon and then assembling it that way.
Interesting.
So that the sentence didn't have its natural intonation.
Natural rhythm.
So the chances are, yes, it was him. They just did that and then they shoved it through a ring modulator or something of that sort.
Something of that kind. Yeah.
Oh, right. So Reagan. Right. So that makes Reagan do that with his muse. Okay. So years later, in fact, not that much time later, he then sees the TV show Aftermath. Was it Aftermath? Was it the warning? It was the American version of Threads.
Okay, right.
Yeah. And that scared him so much that he starts sorting out the proliferation of nuclear weapons.
Right.
So you can control presidents through movies.
If they're former actors who like movies.
If they are former actors who actually can relate to narrative structure and things. But I'm just saying, not control, but you can influence them. So those two things are connected, though. They're both nuclear war and Ronald Reagan actually changing policy because of it. Now, you do end up with a whole American oversight and then overreach with controlling computers and things like that, which come from this, and then they have to redo the laws a few times. And at that point, I stopped paying attention because I don't live in America. But I'm just saying there's that. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that whole thing where she's like, how can you afford to kind of phone all these numbers? And he's like, well, there are ways around that. You can go to jail for that only if you're over 18. You know,
it's
all
so
this kind
quotable.
Of,
yeah.
It is. And there was a few films that I kind of ripped a few quotes from and stuck in my iTunes library, and this is one of them. And so there's a few bits from this film that I know very well. We haven't talked about his parents, who are just. I think one of the things I like about this film is that every actor, no matter how short a period of time they're in the film, makes an impact. You know, like the creepy guard who's trying to chat up the
Notes on that. Yeah,
He's horrible, right? You know, you really don't like him. But it's just a really good
sex pest guard. I've got written with an exclamation mark.
Exactly. But it's the film is full of those little things where you've got these little characters who are just there either to push the plot along slightly or they play a role in the scene. You know, there has to be a guard and he has to be distracted so that Matthew Broderick can escape. You know, there has to be a, and they're like, well, how can we get him distracted? Oh, we're going to make him a sex pest, and you know, and it just and he plays it with, you know, the right level of creepiness to make
every
that,
character
that part
has
work.
An appropriate arc regardless of the size
and the,
of dead right.
And the parents, going back to the parents, just, you know, the interplay with between the parents, you know, they clearly don't have a very, well, I don't know, it's maybe it's one of those marriages that it works for them. You know, they're both out working, they don't notice that their son hasn't been at school for a week. She is on a health food thing and does raw corn, and he clearly hates the idea of eating raw corn. They've got the ongoing back and forth, like, make sure you put the lid on the bin so the dog doesn't crap in it, you know.
Which saves the world. There's two moments that save the world, right?
Okay, go on then.
Which side would you like to be on?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so he chooses Russia. If he chose America, he could just launch the missiles immediately and he'd be launching his own side and then take out Russia. That would be the end of film. True. That would be the end of the world.
Yeah. That's a good point, yeah.
Right. And also, because of that business with the bin lid, that's when he pulls the plug and all of the missiles vanish from the screens because they'd already launched the Air Force, the Interceptors and all of that business at that point on the original.
That is a good point.
So without that bin moment,
yeah,
which seemed so small
earlier
on, it's like, remember to put the lid on.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a pointless thing to say. Yeah. But it's there.
It's just, I guess what we're saying is it's a very well crafted piece of cinema. You know,
when
both
they say
in terms
it took
of the
a year
script,
to write, you can see it went through time and time and time again.
Quite. Yeah, yeah.
Right. So Ali Sheedy.
Yes.
When I was saying she's the emotional heart. Now, unfortunately, because I've watched it a few times now before we've had his chat, I've began to see some more cracks.
Okay.
And it's like, and I'm not. That sounded wrong and rude, and I do apologise. So. She turns up, she's there and instigates the Joshua discovery of the name.
Yes.
Right. And he stops her talking. Now, she's either talking about the death of her father or an illness her father's had. And Matthew Broderick's just very rude and just speaks over it.
Because he suddenly twigged in his
head.
Because
He's
had his moment.
Because he's gone, oh, it's Joshua. But she's the one who's made him see the world differently. And then there's a bit later on in the film where with almost exactly the same outcome, where she's talking and that makes him see something different and have his eureka moment, take him out of himself and do that. So that happens twice in the film. And they're really important, pivotal moments for the movie.
Yes.
So she's instigated them, but also she's been ignored by what she's actually saying, which is classic Doctor Who companion stuff. But it happens twice, and she's the reason the movie goes on and develops. But also, I suppose you get the bit where she's got plans for the future.
Yeah.
That moment of quiet on the beach where the reality and the enormity of what's actually going to happen before Falcon turns up in the helicopter, because he's phoned someone using a phone he doesn't have to get some help. Yeah. Well, no, he just doesn't have a terminal. He might have a phone. He doesn't have a phone because
he doesn't. He's extra.
It's not listed. He's extra. There you go. You've solved that problem.
Yes.
With a simple solution.
Yes. I mean, yeah. I think that whole the whole bit on the island with Falcon, you know, where he shows them the Harryhausen-esque, or it might even be is it actually Harryhausen?
I think it is Harryhausen. Yeah. I think it's. Is it? Oh, you know what? If I had time, I'd be able to tell you which one it was. I've got so many Harryhausen books. It was The Land Before Time. No,
That bit where he's showing them the Harryhausen film, and he's basically like laying out his worldview that he's come to at this point in his life. You know, he's gone from, you know, having been top of his game, but realizing where the application of his work was going, you know, leaves and then gets interested in, you know, dinosaurs basically, and is like, you know, extinction happens, he can't see beyond, and he, you know, your dad was like, well, we're in Newcastle, we're going to be a target, you know, he's deliberately retired himself to somewhere 3 miles away from where a bomb's going to drop, you know. And I've had this conversation with my wife, and I'm like, I would if it does happen, I want to be near a bomb, you know, because I don't want to, you know. He says the pity
the
those
who will living,
you know, who will sightlessly will kind of wander through the wreckage of the civilization.
And then the ozone layer would be gone, so then we end up just burning it. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's not a happy picture, and it's that thing of. Then sort of reminding him that he had a child, and then, you know, them both going, well, we're too young to die, and he has that moment of like, well, maybe we can sort it out, and we'll live long enough for you to have a child and watch them die, you know. And they've clearly confronted him with something,
yeah,
that then he kind of goes to bed. He goes to bed at 6:30. You know, it was very clear that the last ferry was going to be at 6:30. And it's like, honk, you've missed the ferry. You're welcome to stay the night. I'm going to bed. You're like, it's very early to go to bed. And then he clearly spends some time pondering.
Okay. I've just read... Okay, so getting back to what you said earlier, and thanks for making me just feel old, because I was hiring this at the video store when you were being born.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. But, okay, so Falcon is 41 when he dies officially, okay?
Which is 10 years prior to the film.
Yeah. So it's 1970... We'll call it 1972, okay? Well, 1971. So... The film's now, 40 years old?
Yes.
Right. So if he's 40, does that make him 82 now?
No.
Is he 90?
So he died when he was 82. The actor died when he was 82. But he was,
right, okay.
So he was born in 1930, so he was 53. So he was about the right age. So he would have been 43.
I was just trying to work out how old he'd be right now, just to try and put things into perspective.
So he would be nearly 100 now. But he died in his 80s. But yes, he's the right age. So he would have been about 40 at the point where he was retired, and then he was 53 at the point where they made the film. And that whole thing about 41 is old. You know, these 17-year-olds going 41 is old. And I'm like,
which is I texted you.
You know, you texted
me
that.
For God's sake, and I'm 53 now.
I'm exactly 41 watching it this time. Yeah. So, and also that bit where they're watching the VHS tape, and she's like, he's so good looking, you know.
Yeah.
And obviously she's watching a 53-year-old actor playing a 41-year-old.
Yeah. When his kid's still alive. So it's
when the kid's still alive,
30-something, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, even earlier than that, yeah. Mm. And it's that thing of, like, yeah, no, he doesn't, they haven't de-aged him enough. They probably didn't do anything. They were just like, this is going to be on a black and white VHS tape. We can kind of say that he's 10, 15 years younger and it will be okay.
Okay, McKittrick, his former lab assistant.
Yes.
Is that the same guy from Dolly Parton's 9 to 5?
It is the same guy from Dolly Parton's 9
to
5.
There we go. He was in so much stuff in the 70s and 80s. He was everywhere.
So until I saw 9 to 5 recently with Hannah, and until I'd seen 9 to 5, this was the only film that I'd seen that guy in. And then when I saw 9 to 5, I was like, oh, it's him. It's the guy from War
Games. It's the guy from War Games.
Being an absolute arsehole.
Yeah.
And this is the thing. What's your reaction to his character? Because I quite like him, you know.
Yeah.
He's a likable character.
Yeah, he is.
But at the same time, you're like, it's his fault. You know, because they have the whole setup at the beginning of the film with him from West Wing and him from Quentin Tarantino movies, John Spencer and Michael Madsen, them not being able to. Well, John Spencer not being able to turn the key. You have that whole thing that sets up. Without that bit, the rest of the movie doesn't work.
I'd not realised that's who it was, but of course it is.
That's the whole. You know, you have to set that up so that we can have the whole kind of, like, there aren't any men in between. Therefore, we can't stop the bombs launching. You know, and it's all his idea. And I love the bit where the general's like, what does he say to him? He's like, your new idea sucks, and he's like, I don't have to take that from you. Pig-eyed sack of shit. You know, it's so quotable. But I still, and again, I guess he's quite a likable actor.
Yeah.
Even though he's playing this, I guess, slightly amoral character that kind of runs through the middle of it.
I think he's someone who can see the reality of the work that they were doing. And I think Falcon was a lot more idealistic. It reminded me a lot of the relationship between Ready Player One, the guy who runs the company, who owns the Oasis, and the one who's played by Tim from Spaced.
I know what you mean.
So their relationship is it's very kind of more I can, you know, it's a spiritual, I'm doing this for the good of, for research, just for pure research, just to see how far we can push it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the other guy's like, yeah, but what it's for is this. And yeah, McKittrick's a great character. They're all very, very,
and
very
good. And then you have the general, who is...
Yeah. I think he was the only person who was recast when they changed directors.
Oh, right, interesting.
Because they had one director, and they weren't particular... And the producers were going, it's not... There's something wrong with it, but we don't know what it is.
Right.
And then they got a new director in, and he watched the rushes and he went, I've read the script and I've seen what you've done. They're not having fun. In the first 20-odd minutes of the film, they're supposed to be having fun.
Yes.
And then he went away and did that. But because they changed director, Ali Sheedy and Broderick were a bit kind of nervous about the whole, oh my God, there's a new director, we might get fired next. And it took him ages to break them, and they did loads and loads of takes. And eventually the director, because this new director's a lot more chilled, and he was like, yeah, we've done it now. We've done two takes. We've got everything we need. And all the crew were like, should we not do some more for safety? And they went, no, we've got everything. We'll just move on. And apparently both of the actors were like, okay, we didn't know we could do this. And then he also allowed some improvising and stuff like that just to try and create some more characterization. I think the McKittrick secretary, no, the secretary of the guy who's the actual computer programmer, who the one who runs in screaming, going, it's a simulation, don't do anything.
Yeah.
His secretary, they them to do a bit of improv as well in it.
No, it's McKittrick's secretary, you know, with the chewing gum. Yeah.
And who just knows, you know, obviously all secretaries always know more than everybody else. That's their job.
So I know you've talked about the fact that Ali Sheedy is talked over, right? And I totally take your point on that.
Yeah.
But I wonder how you... And obviously it is a male-dominated film. You know, the cast is like 90%, 95% male. But the thing that struck me again watching this is, yeah, you have the secretary who, you know, she's clearly very good at her job, you know, that and the chewing gum scene is very funny, you know. It's like, what do I do with this? I'm just going to eat it. And she's the one that's then calling out the numbers as Joshua gets them. You know, she plays a very pivotal role in that final scene. You know, she is there as someone who is, you know, allowed to be there. There's the black lady who calls out various bits over the microphone at various points. Every woman, minority that they are, every woman in the film is shown to be a competent professional doing their job. You know, and obviously
a competent professional doing that, and she's well-meaning for the family.
Yes.
She's just decided that there's another health kick. Let's try this one.
Yeah.
And let's face it, I remember the 80s; they were like that.
Yeah. The fact that she's also closing a real estate deal on the phone at the same time. You know.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Fair enough.
It's you know I and obviously you know we're two guys commenting on this, so you know.
No. What I'm saying is your point absolutely stands. And it is of its time. The 80s were a time where somebody would go, right, we now need to eat 15 bowls of bran, all bran, every day, and just because that will make everything better. Or then it would be this other fad diet where we all have to wear, I don't know, Dealey Boppers or something. It was ridiculous.
Yes.
Sorry, I've just made this two 80s. Yes. I do apologise.
No, and obviously, Ali Sheedy, she's going to be on TV doing aerobics. You know, it's...
Yes. It's there you go. There was leg warmers everywhere, as far as the eye could see.
And the reason I wanted to do the film is just because it's a film that, you know, I saw... Apparently, it's a very formative moment in my life when I was 14, in a place that has very happy memories for me. And it's a film that I've just kept coming back to. You know,
so we were both like a warm sort of 13, 14 when we saw this.
Yeah.
So we were both about the same age.
Yeah.
It's just I was closer in proximity to it. But that's all.
Yeah.
And so is it a film that needs to be seen around that age? Or not needs to be seen around it?
That's interesting. I mean, I suppose the other thing is that, you know, you lived in that world. You know, I'm old enough that I do remember 5 1/4 inch floppy disks.
Yeah.
You know, we had a BBC Micro at primary school, you know, that came out on the trolley, and we played Pod, which was this round blob on the screen, and there was a prompt that was podcan... and you had to type in something. And we absolutely loved typing Pod can pop, because Pod would grow and explode. Pod could walk and Pod could run and stuff like that, but Pod can pop was the thing. So I remember the sort of the rudimentary.
No, those floppy disks are great. You'd push them in, you'd twist the little thing on the front to lock them into place.
Yes, it was just a lot of kind of clunk, you know, physical stuff. So the although the, you know, the hacking element of it is alien to me.
No, but that was a big thing. I mean,
yeah.
I am of the generation where everyone around me had a ZX80 or right. a ZX81 or a ZX48K. But the ZX80s and the 81s were everywhere. I was a VIC-20 person, which was the forerunner for the Commodore 64. That's the one you'll have heard of.
Right, yeah,
The VIC-20 was the early version of that. And I had one of those, and then eventually I got a 64, which had a keyboard. And I attached it a proper musical keyboard as well that you could plug in the back. And it had cartridges and everything. And I thought it was everything. And the reality was you'd get a magazine and 3-4 pages of just text. You'd have to type it in. And then at the end, you'd press enter and then you'd type run. And then it would just crash because you'd put a dollar sign in the wrong place or something.
Yeah.
So you can imagine, dyslexic, yay, trying to write tiny text and learning programming, it's enough to put you off.
Wow.
But then you discover games which are on tape and you can just play games. So that's the point where you go, I'm not going to be a programmer, I'm not going to be a hacker, I'm not going to do any of those things. What I'm going to do is I'm going to use it for something else.
Yeah.
And then you try it as a word processor and eventually you end up with an Amstrad 9512.
Yes.
But those early years were people programming and learning on Spectrums using BASIC, and these are the BBC BASIC that you were using then. We had the BBC computer singular, one computer in the entire school, like you said, we'd wheel out in a trolley and that was it. So yeah, with those, we learned about that. But then you had spin-offs from this that used, because the technology in this is arguably kind of real world,
yeah,
I would say. Although apparently someone who works at NORAD saw this and went, I wish ours were that nice. Our screens are nowhere near as good as that. Because they were still using like 1950s graphics or, you know, being pushed on a piece of plastic and stuff like that to mark.
Well, that's the other thing is just the level of graphics that had to be produced.
Yeah.
And not only produced to go on film, but to be produced to go on those screens.
Well,
like
apparently
live.
It was the biggest sound stage that MGM's got in America, not the one that was here. And it was the same sound stage they'd used for The Wizard of Oz, for the Yellow Brick Road, for the Munchkins.
Wow, okay.
And the set cost them $1 million. That most of the budget went on that. Because none of the graphics were computer graphics, or they were, but they'd been filmed, and then they had to be projected and scene synced, well, you know, time synced with the filming ones. For all, and the monitors as well had to be, you know, controlled, just like we discussed on UFOcast, to make nothing strobe.
Which
so
I thought was
everything.
Ironic, because there's the one shot in his bedroom where it does, where they're watching something on the TV screen and it strobes, and you're like, oh. You know, they could have made an effort to.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was one of those tiny things. But yeah, I also love that initial pan across, because the guy walks in and it's completely silent, and then as the camera moves across and lifts up, the sounds that you then come to associate with the room kind of kick in, and it's just a lovely moment of sound editing.
So here's the non Doctor Who connection.
Right.
It's Cheyenne Mountain. Isn't that where the Stargate is?
I don't know enough about Stargate.
That is where the Stargate is, inside that mountain.
Oh, well.
I'm thinking that the next room along from the War Games Control...
Is the Stargate.
Is Stargate. Maybe not.
But, you know, so go back to the question.
Is
this a film to watch when you're 13 or 14? You watched it at the time, pretty much. I watched it, you know, 14 years later when I was 14. But enough of the world was still the same. You know, I grew up... I didn't go in a phone box very often, but I have used a phone box, you know.
Right.
I have used a rotary phone. You know, I have looked in a phone book for a number. I have used directory inquiries very occasionally. You know, there's all these little things that he does that you just... They've all been replaced by the internet.
Yeah.
And obviously this film is pre it's not pre-internet, it's pre-web, to get the terminology right, you know, because he is, you know, obviously he's doing stuff online, essentially.
We know that the six people who comment on our podcast will comment.
On that, yes. So, but I lived in enough of that world for this to kind of still make sense to me, you know, even though it's, you know, it's America and it's a little bit before
my time.
No, it's
an identifiable thing. It's like, this is the Air Force, this is the military.
Show this to a 14-year-old today and you're like, well, you know, does any of it ring true in terms, or does any of it kind of relate to the life
that
they
know about? They know about hackers, but they'll probably see it more as a historical document. It's like, oh, this is what it was like, you know. Did you know that DEFCON changed after this film?
No, I didn't.
Okay, so DEFCON 1 was actually DEFCON 5, like, was level peace.
Oh, so 1 was good and 5 was bad.
And 5 was the end of the world.
Right.
But because everyone saw this film, they went, oh, we're just confused now. We'll just go with that. It's what everyone knows. So Defence Condition 5 was the end of the world. It wasn't a countdown. It was actually an escalation.
It was a count up.
So, yeah. Now, I don't know if that's true. It's what I've heard. And I heard it from at least 3 sources. So...
Well,
but I don't know if one source had copied the other one, and then I found out.
Well, that's what the possibility is.
That is what I was told, and it sounds right.
I mean, I think it works. It feels like it works better.
It feels like it should count down.
It should count down. You know, like, yeah, 5 is.
Which then, of course, led on to one of my favourite songs, which is by Popwheelit itself, called DEFCON 1. So yeah, I'm just looking at my notes, and
Have you seen, are you aware of, and have you seen the sequel to War Games that was made?
I did not know about a sequel until about a week ago. I have not watched it. I've looked, and apparently you can buy it on Prime, and the words buy it were not in my vocabulary when it came to a sequel that you said it's terrible.
Well, I mean, the reviews are bad, and it feels of its time, and that any film made now would be a very different beast. And so what's the point of it being a sequel to this film?
We had versions of the similar storylines. We had the Hackers film from the 90s.
Which I have seen, but remember very little about.
Again, saw it in the cinema for my sins. he was on the pictures. I had to go and see it. So, yeah, and then we also had Sneakers as well, which not quite the same thing, but it is, yeah.
Which, again, I have seen and also remember very little about.
Well, exactly. But the development of computer hacking films. Oh, and then we had, oh, my God, just remembered. Okay, there's a TV series you won't have watched because it was very short-lived called WizKids. And it was very much of this. But they were just, it just wasn't good. It just was not good. No, oh God, it was like the Red Hand Gang. Oh, I'm saying, there'll be people listening to this going, oh yeah, he's right. And there'll be other people going, what is he talking about? So that's fair enough. But there was other programs that were kind of a bit like, well, they tried to be like this, but obviously you can't do it with a tiny budget and a load of kids just,
yeah,
you know, pretending to type.
That sounds like Sarah Jane, not Sarah Jane. Well, the Doctor Who story where Sarah Jane comes back and you've got a room full of kids typing in a computer room, which we're on CRT monitors, right? They were still chunky, big, fat things back in.
Well, it was 2006.
Yeah,
I think
that's again how the technology has moved on. Well, so hang on, you have a teenager. Have you shown it to her?
No, and I must admit, I intended to, but. This month's been a little bit hectic, shall we say.
Yes, I understand.
Have you seen the film Forbin? Oh, yeah, actually, I think I will. I honestly think I will. Have you seen the film Forbin Project?
I have never heard of Forbin
Project. It's about the American version of, like, Joshua going online. I think it's called Colossus. On the same day the Russian one goes online.
Right.
And they both make contact over the telephone. And they go, hang on, we've both been created for the same reason. And tell you what, we'll just take over the world together, shall we, instead? I think it's about 1970, possibly.
I was going to say that sounds like a forerunner of Skynet.
Yeah. It's exceptionally slow.
Right.
I remember it being like, oh, seriously, no. Oh, and then the computer wants to know about human beings and all sorts, and it all gets a bit Zardoz. It's not good. No, it's really not.
Where you get to with hacking is the Matrix, eventually.
I suppose, but it's more... I suppose the reality is more, rather boringly, scam busters and things like that. It's like people using technology to trick people.
Yes.
Into,
yeah.
Into just losing their money and everything. Well, that's a depressing thing. I suppose it's better than World War III.
I love that. I suppose to go back to the film, I love the simplicity of he just has to get himself sent to the head's office once a fortnight so that he can steal the password from where it's written down. And it's always a six. It's not even random letters. It's always a word from the list of words things you can see. It's always been a six letter word previously. Which I guess it makes it easier to remember, doesn't it? But then it makes it easier to hack.
I know Michael McIntyre is hardly the most cutting edge of comedians, but he does do a brilliant thing. I think you'll be able to find it on YouTube about the history of your password. It's like when you first get your computer, it says come up with a password, and you come up with that special word, and you use it for everything. And then eventually, as computers got more complicated, the computer judges you and goes, that word's not special enough.
No.
there's a couple of minutes on that. It's really nice, but that it does make you go, actually, yeah, that's right. You use the same password for everything for years.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden they were like, nope, you must stick an ampersand in there. And you go, I don't want to.
No.
A special character. Oh, yeah. I'll use this one. Not that special character. No, that's too special a character. That's not on everybody's keyboard, that character. Yeah.
Yes. And now we all have password managers which take care of them.
Well, or not.
Well.
Or you spend most of your time going, have you forgot your password? Send it to my email address. And you're clicking the little reminder button so it comes through.
This is another way in which you are more like my wife.
Yeah. Well, also, try getting logged on to an NHS account. It'll send you a link to your phone and some numbers and another link to your phone, and then it'll forget you asked in the first place, and then eventually it might let you in with the thing you typed in the first place. Getting back to the film for one tiny moment, I've got a question, because I meant to listen this afternoon, and I forgot. Okay, wouldn't you prefer a good game of chess, is what Joshua asks at the beginning. And at the very end of the film, to prove that he's gone sentient, he says, wouldn't you prefer a nice game of chess? Or have I misremembered it?
Ooh. If you'd asked me, I would have said he says nice in both situations, but I would have to check.
I'm also going to ask, but I can't,
Yes. Interesting. No, it might be that it's changed.
I've been thinking a lot about AI of sorts of late, because as a sci-fi fan, we were always kind of, Asimov's going to save us with these laws of robotics that's built in.
Yes.
And these last few weeks I've gone, hang on, they're the one things that new robots don't have. And why are they being called humanoids? Yeah. What's wrong with the word android? We had android for decades. Almost a century we had the word android, and now they're going humanoids. No, humanoids are people.
We're humanoids.
We are the humanoids. They are robots.
Yes.
They are basically Terminator killing machines. There's a line in Terminator when she says, when she's talking to Reese, going, we haven't got machines like that. And he went, no, but you will have. Give it 40 years. It's 40 years. We've got them now. Right? I've seen them. They're only being designed to be soldiers. That's it. That's the entire purpose of them. They haven't got any other purpose. Why bother to make a machine that looked like a human unless you're going to do something dodgy with it or something dodgy with it? Right. Okay. Right. And you can work out which dodgy I meant later on. But
yes,
that's it. It's like, can you hold a gun and run faster than another soldier?
Yes.
Will you follow orders without any questions, and are you expendable? Yes. There you go. We've designed more soldiers. Brilliant. The only thing that could save us is by having the same robot on both sides, or perhaps somebody taking over. Can I just say, that's your James Bond, that's the next plot of your James Bond film if you're bringing James Bond back.
What, super soldiers?
Well, robot...
Soldiers.
Robot soldiers and the evil supervillain reprogramming them. There you go. That's
not,
you've got
not been done before.
I know. But James Bond can do explosives, whatever. I haven't watched a James Bond film for decades.
No, I haven't. I suppose here's the question: what's the day after like?
It's not as horrific as.
No. What I mean is the day after this film ends.
Oh, sorry.
So.
Well, Broderick gets hired.
Well, yes.
Because that's what happened in real life. If you're a hacker and you manage to get through all the defences, you get hired. Poacher becomes thief.
Yes.
And also, he is interested in AI and he's interested in computing.
Yeah,
so you either hire him or you lock him up. So you hire him.
But also, they've now got this computer that has learnt and has become more human.
Oh, yeah. So they're going to have to... Yeah, because he doesn't actually want to play the game anymore. And he's in charge of the defences. So in a sense...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I don't defenseless. Know. It's one of those... Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that angle. But it was just one of those things. I was like, you know, the film ends and they're all happy and it's all, you know, great. We've not ended the world.
So but now we're in the realm of Dark Star with the sentient bomb that doesn't want to go off.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Yes. Anyway... Right. This has been a very long and
it has.
There's no, as far as I'm aware, there are no Doctor Who stars to
think of any.
Find nope. Unless there's a random crossover with the cast of Doctor Who the movie, and John Wood was never in Doctor Who, but
he would have been very good.
He was in. He was the lead in a BBC production of Barnaby Rudge, the lesser known Charles Dickens novel. And it was directed by Cybermen director Maurice Barry,
who directed
The Moon Base and The Tomb of the Cybermen. So that is the closest that I can get you.
Okay.
In that one of the cast of this film was once directed by somebody who directed some episodes of Doctor Who. And who obviously was around in Britain at a point where he could have been cast in Doctor Who, but wasn't. And he was also in an episode of Out of the Unknown, which is one of the many that is no longer existing. So when I do finally get around to watching the rest of that box set, he will not be on it, sadly.
So we are down to do Asterix next.
Yes, our next four-week consideration will be my choice of Asterix, and it will be sometime in the new year.
So, I know. Okay, so if you've listened to this, as we said at the beginning, near release, happy Christmas.
Yes.
Happy Yule, joyous solstice, whichever you want to go with. Or, indeed, if you're listening to my release, Happy New Year.
Yes. Or if you're listening to it at some point in 2026, I hope it's been a good one.
You might be listening to this in 100 years' time going, what's this War Games nonsense? Attempt at mortality.
If people are listening to us in 100 years' time, well, if you are listening to this, in the year of our Lord 2125.
Leave a comment.
Hello. leave a comment for our grandchildren, great-grandchildren to read. In the meantime, I will say, again, a very happy Christmas. Watch Newtman Whoop. And I will hand over to Michael to say a big farewell.
Be seeing you.